Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
Welcome to the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association podcast. I'm your host, Alisa Minkin. I'm a general pediatrician and member of JOMA's Preventative Health Committee. I am doing my first episode with not one, but two amazing professionals, Mrs. Yael Braun and Anna Sherman, the therapist. I'm going to introduce Yael Braun first. Yael Braun is an advocate, the first TOENIS, which is a female advocate in the Beis Din in the United States, and the founder of Superior Family Liaison Services. In addition to fiercely representing her clients in Beis Din, Mrs. Braun flawlessly bridges the gap between Rabbanim, Askanim, mediators, arbitrators, attorneys, and her clients. Her knowledge, experience, and professionalism gives her the expertise to best guide her clients on every aspect of their marital dispute. Mrs. Braun is widely acknowledged as an unmatched champion for the rights of her clients. Mrs. Braun will do everything needed to ensure her clients are properly advocated for in Beis Din, mediation, and arbitration. With her deep compassion and unwavering attention to detail, she navigates her clients through the unsettling time of getting divorced. Mrs. Braun's creativity, outside-of-the-box thinking, loyalty, and dedication to her clients remains unmatched. Yael can be found on Instagram as The Divorce Specialist. So welcome, Yael.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for doing this with us. Anna Sherman is here for her third visit, her third interview with me. I'll mention in a minute how this is a series of three. I'll get to that in a second. Anna Sherman is a registered psychotherapist, maternal mental health practitioner, and clinical supervisor in Toronto. She works with individuals, couples, and families, as well as supervises qualifying therapists in their training. She helps her clients to heal and overcome trauma, fears, and emotional blocks in their lives and relationships by building skills and tools to help them help themselves. Anna loves working with new mothers and helping women to live empowered, authentic, and intentional lives. And here I'm going to put that plug for your upcoming book in. She is the author of the upcoming book, The Empowered Woman's Journal, to be found on Amazon in the next few months. Simrit Sashem?
Yep, we hope so.
Super
exciting.
We definitely
hope so.
Super exciting.
Thank you.
Anna holds a master's degree in marriage and family therapy and is specially trained in cognitive behavior therapy, emotionally focused therapy, the Gottman Method, maternal mental health, family systems theory, mindfulness, meditation, and psychodynamic therapy. Anna can be found, and I'm getting this right this time, AnnaShermanMFT.com and on Instagram.
No.
No? What?
AnnaShermanRP.com.
What's MFT? Okay. AnnaShermanRP.com.
Correct.
Third time, still wrong. Sorry. Okay. I do want to put a warning out here that we're going to be talking about some really sensitive topics today. Please note this talk is for mature audiences and will cover topics such as spouse abuse, substance abuse, mental illness, and others. So we're going to talk about divorce, but from a mental health lens, that of the couple and their children if they have them. And as I mentioned earlier, this is my third talk with Anna Sherman, my first with Yael Braun. And those talks are Marrying Well on the Mental Health of Our Single Woman and the Shidduch System and Love Shouldn't Hurt on Intimate Partner Violence. So let's start by talking about just what are some reasons that people get divorced and also about the divorce in the Jewish world as opposed to the secular world. I know I said two things. So I'm going to give Anna a turn. Mm-hmm. And then Yael, because it's different perspectives, which is why I had you on together.
Okay. All right. So some reasons why people are getting divorced. So there are some good reasons why people are getting divorced, and there are some not very good reasons why people are getting divorced. I like to say, as a general rule, and I know this sounds kind of like everyone's going to have a different interpretation of this, and it sounds kind of vague, but I like to say, a good time to get divorced is when there is nothing left to work with. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that makes sense, but what I mean by that is whatever it is that's plaguing your marriage, if there's stuff you can work with, in other words, both of you are committed to the process, you know, there is an underlying foundation there, but somehow you guys have gotten off track and you need some work getting back on track. These are all things you can work with. You have crazy schedules and you need some help with that. Your communication is lacking. There's, you know, you've sort of lost that spark, and but you feel like if you actually had more time and some help to get it back, you could, you know what I'm saying? Anything mm-hmm. you can really work with. But if you've gotten to the point where there is nothing left to work with, in other words, you've been like, you were never a really good match from the beginning, and you've just sort of like been, you know, the last 5, 10, 15 years, just like kid after kid, filling your time with like, you know, just having lots of kids and focusing on the kids, or trying to believe that it can, that you will grow in love together, but like you never do. Or like you just disagree on more things, you know, than you agree on. Very few of your interactions are really positive. You're just not happy. You know, these are all things that where you could come to the conclusion where there's really not a whole lot left to work with. Mm-hmm. In other words, maybe you really just are not a good match. Or the other thing that could be is if there is an issue, a mental health issue mm-hmm. that either was there from the beginning or has developed, there could be an abuse issue, or there could be an addictions issue. All these things could be worked with, and then sometimes you can get to the point where there is nothing left to work with. In other words, the mental health issue, sometimes you can work with it. Sometimes the individual or the couple can get help. There's medications, there's therapies, there are programs. And then sometimes it's too far gone and you can't work with it. And sometimes the person that you married is now not the person that you are now married to was not the person you married because mm-hmm. the mental health is, you know, deteriorated. The abuse can always be worked with. Sometimes the abuser is very eager to get help and recognize their destructive behaviors and their abusive behaviors. That can be worked with. Sometimes the abuser is completely, we talked about this in the last episode, they have no intention of changing their behaviors, getting help, or even admitting that they're doing anything wrong. That cannot be worked with. So that if that's the case, and you're the victim, you're the only one that's doing the work, pushing your partner to go get help, there is nothing left to work with there. That would be a reason to get divorced. Addictions, same thing. If the individual if the addict recognizes they have the problem, oh, I need, you know, I want to get the help, or otherwise I'm going to lose my marriage, my family, my children, my job. I'm going to get myself to AA. I'm going to get myself to an addiction center. I want to work on this. I want to get, control of my mental health and my addictions. Okay. Then you have a lot to work with. A lot to work with, tons of potential. But if you're the one, if you're the spouse who's living with an addict and you're saying, please, please, please change. Get help. And, mm-hmm. and your partner is saying, my drinking's not a problem. You just think it's a problem, or a little drugs here and there, or, you know, my pornography addiction. It's not an addiction. All men like pornography, you know, then there is nothing left to work with. These are all reasons that you could be getting divorced. Other reasons to be getting divorced are you're just, the two of you are not happy. The relationship is more draining than fulfilling. And if you can't change that, then, you know, that's not looking like a good future. That doesn't play out well for a good foundation. It's also not good for the kids to see both parents having a more draining life than a fulfilling life. The majority of your actions are not positive. You might have some positive interactions, but the majority are negative. That is not good for either one of you. You're constantly finding reasons to just avoid your partner. That's not really a good sign. Your instincts are kind of telling you that there's nothing left to work with, and you're feeling it in the gut. You're kind of living like roommates. You're sort of living separate lives, passing like two ships in the dark, whatever. And not even realizing you've just fallen into that pattern. That could be a sign that you're heading towards divorce. And just the general sense of like, everything is just hard with this person. Every little thing just gets hard.
Wow. That is a really comprehensive explanation. Thank you. And I want to hear from Yael too.
For sure. You know, a big thing that I see personally in my own practice and just doing what I do, is, you know, a whole entire array of different things. Mm-hmm. But I think the bottom line is it's what you're willing to deal with. Everybody has boundaries. Everybody has their line in the sand, and what their values are and what they feel that they can handle. I see a lot of cheating. I see a lot of abuse. I see a lot of people who said it just wasn't a match and we haven't fallen in love yet. And it's been 5 years or 10 years, oh, 20 wow. years, or 30 years. Yeah. I see a lot of, you know, they got into a rut. It was great in the beginning. They got into a rut. It's a few years later. They haven't gotten out of the rut. I see mental health issues. I see drug abuse. I see, you know, sometimes I'll get a client that says, I don't know, my spouse just snapped. They're just not who they are anymore and they won't get therapy. They won't help themselves. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and I just can't, and I can't just sit here and enable when they're just not well and they're refusing to get help. But I think at the end of the day, it just has to do with what your line in the sand is, and how long you're willing, how much you're willing to take and how long you're willing to take it. That's right. What I think.
Right. So back to divorce in the Jewish religious communities versus the rest of the world. I'm wondering, you know, what, you know, you can tell us about that. I will say that before I started this talk, I found an article from the Jewish Action, if people want to read it. It's called The Data on Divorce, Questions and Answers with Dr. Yitzhak Schechter from the Jewish Action on 2015. And so he said that the rate of divorce in the Jewish world is about 10%, which you could say, wow, that's so high, except if you compare it to the rest of the world, it's like 50%. So then you could say, wow, yeah, that's so low. So I'm just curious with, right, you know, this is what you do, what your experience is with divorce in the religious world, Jewish world, as opposed to the rest of the world. I know it's a very broad question.
So for me personally, you know, it's very interesting because my knee-jerk reaction is because there's such a stigma.
Mm-hmm.
And Anna could definitely say, you know, about the stigma in the religious world, about how it's very much looked down upon. A lot of people in the religious world or in the Jewish world will not get divorced, not just because of the stigma, because they're scared they're never going to find somebody else, you mm-hmm. know, and they have more children. So it's much harder to support the children on, you know, with one parent in a single household, single family household, single parent household, excuse me. So between that and the stigma itself, and the rumors and the, you know, oh, I heard they got divorced. You know, we're a much smaller community. We're not like the community at large where you could live in a totally separate town than your parents and a totally separate town than your closest friends and not have any mutual friends in common with your other friends and this. Right. And, you know what I mean? Whereas with us, we have a whole entire internal infrastructure where, you know, everybody knows somebody else. So, you know, rumors get around. If somebody talks, the whole world is going to talk. Something in, you know, Anna's community in Toronto could come right into Lakewood. And to find a new partner is much harder because of the rumors and because of that and the stigma. So I believe the reason why it's lower is because of the stigma, and not just that, but because of the repercussions of possibly mm-hmm. not getting married. If someone has five kids, they're going to have a lot harder time getting remarried, as opposed to if they had one child. And sometimes, unfortunately, in the religious world, they rather just bite the bullet, stay in an unhappy marriage, then get divorced because they're so scared of not, you know, getting remarried. And I think another thing on top of all of that is it's just not something that's accepted. And I'm saying this is besides the stigma. It's
right.
It's something that a lot of women especially are not educated in. They feel like if they get divorced, they're going to be stuck with all the bills. They're going to never see their children again, or husbands feel they'll never see their children again. There isn't a lot of education on divorce. So because of that, people are too scared to do it. And also, sometimes they don't even know that what they're going through is not what they have to deal with. Meaning some people, especially in the ultra religious world, some women will say, well, of course my husband, you know, gets mad at me and ignores me for 2 days because I didn't quote unquote behave. Mm-hmm. That is a narrative I hear a lot. I didn't behave.
Yeah.
Which is heartbreaking because they feel that they deserve the treatment that they get is because they don't behave. Or I saw my father do that, so that's why it's okay. This is normal for my family. So I think all of that together, I think that is why the percentage is so low. It's a mixture between the stigma, the fear. And I think also, you know, in our circles, I think that the fear of divorce is so strong that sometimes they are willing just to go to therapy and kibosh the issues because they're so scared of divorce. Whereas maybe in other communities, they'll let it fester a little bit more.
Right. And, you know, the idea that people are in our communities are just, you know, getting divorced for superficial reasons at the drop of the hat, you would say that would be quite mistaken. I would say the opposite would be true.
Absolutely.
Because there's so much tremendous pressures. And you didn't even mention what it's like for you know, a woman or a man to be single parent in community that is really only set up for a two-parent family.
Correct. And right? And also, a lot of times they think of the kids. Okay, my kid's not going to be able to get married. They need a shidduch. So we can't be divorced. It looks bad on the family and the rumors, and this could come out, that come out. It's a lot. It's a lot of pressure to stay married.
Right. And by the way, in this article, Dr. Yitzhak Schechter gave a very interesting piece of information. He said that it's a myth that in the religious Jewish world, that children of divorce are more likely to become divorced people. It is true in the non-Jewish world. It is not true, according to his statistics in the Jewish world. So I thought that was interesting. So he talks about the fear for shidduchim, you know, to the stigma of somebody coming from a divorced family is completely unwarranted. So I thought that was an interesting point.
That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's one thing that came from this article. Another thing that came from the article, and I'll give you some more time to talk about what you do as a Toenis, is that they said that even though the divorce rate in the Jewish world is low compared to the non-Jewish world, very frequently they're contentious. And, you know, and I was reading your introduction about all the different people you're mediating between. There's a lot of people involved in a Jewish divorce. I mean, also just the way you said that, like, we're all intertwined. It's not like, you know, you're all by yourself. In a way, it's good. Our greatest strength, you know, that we're a close-knit community also creates a lot of people with a lot of
drama.
I really wanted to learn more from you about what it's like from the basting process and, you know, what you do as a Toenis.
Okay, so I represent my clients in Beis Din. So in mm-hmm. litigation, it's like I'm a non-lawyer lawyer, mm-hmm. but I only represent my clients in Beis Din or other arbitration or mediation. I try to broker a deal between my client and the other party. I try to make things as painless as possible because it is a very painful process. No matter what community you belong to or where you live. But I think, like you said, because everyone's so intertwined, even more so in the religious community. Mm-hmm. So I make sure to advocate for my client. I make sure that we have a great strategy. I love going to Beis Din. I love litigating. You know, I live for it. It's my absolute favorite thing in the world. And I also do case management. So if, you know, a client has an attorney and they're not in Beis Din, but they're in the secular courts, then a lot of times I help deal with the attorneys, with the various family members as well, because we're so intertwined and everyone has an opinion. I always say that there's, you know, too many cooks, as everyone, a lot of people say, too many cooks spoil the broth. Mm-hmm. I throw all the cooks out. I'm the chef. I delegate if necessary, but I'm the chef. And even if everyone thinks they're a better chef, that's fine, but I'm the chef. Because what happens is when too many people become the point person, nothing gets done and everyone just fights. So I take over.
How is it different from it being a mediator?
Because a mediator talks to both parties and tries to make a deal happen, tries to make an agreement. I don't work for both parties. I work for my client and I speak to the mediator and I try and get the best deal possible. And, you know, there's a lot of back and forth when you're a mediator. That's why I don't do it. Because you also have to be very, you have to be very, what's the word I'm looking for?
Political.
Political and
diplomatic.
Diplomatic. And that's never been my strong suit in life. So, I know my weaknesses and my strengths and this ain't it. So, that's why the mediator is kind of like the arbiter, you know, and you go back and forth and you make sure, or I make sure that the client gets the best deal possible. And I do a lot of negotiation in that way. And I also love negotiating. So it works out really well.
Are your clients all women?
No, I see both. I started out just as women, just with women. And then I started, men started calling me with these really sad stories. And I said to myself, I said, listen, like, what am I going to do? Like, I want to be this champion for women, but you know, women aren't the only people getting the raw end of the deal here.
Right.
And I realized that I had to go with my gut and do what I felt was best for me and my family, which was helping everybody. I did speak to a lot of different people about it, obviously. I spoke to Rabbanim and my family and everything, because it's a little bit sticky in the religious world for a woman to represent a man when you're not really a lawyer, but you're going to Beis Din and there's a lot of meetings involved and, you know, but it needed to happen. I think, although the injustices in the religious divorce world, there are a lot of injustices that happen to women. They do happen to men as well, and I think that's been a big fault that people don't realize and hasn't been discussed about enough.
I think that's a good segue just to briefly touch on parental alienation syndrome, because that is getting so much press. That is such a hot topic in the film world. I'm going to give Anna a turn to talk and explain what that is, because I've heard the term. I don't even fully understand it. But I just want to say ahead of time, we're not going to go too deep into this, because this is an entire podcast episode waiting to be made.
Right. Okay. So yeah, it's not my, target.
It's very specialized,
but yeah, basically it's when there is a conflict going on in a family. It's usually, you know, to do with the separation or divorce of the parents of the family. And one parent has this idea that things will go better in the separation or in the divorce or just in the situation in general if they somehow poison the kids against the other parent and just kind of bring the kids along with them, just slowly over time, you know, just like distance the other parents away from the kids as much as they can. Yael, is that how you understand it?
Yeah. Also that, it's a means of control. It's to cut out the other parent, to poison the child against the parent, like you said. And that way the parent also gets the validation that they were right and the other, their spouse was wrong.
Right. And the problem the main problem that I see with it, which I see in families who are going through it currently, but also in families who went through it like many years ago, is that people don't realize it in the moment, but like it's tremendously damaging to your children, because children, you know, I mean, children need to grow up with strong, clear, and secure attachment figures in their lives. Attachment is a whole big concept in therapy, and it's like really, really important. And if a child learns that one of their attachment figures, in other words, one of the people in their life who they're securely attached to, who they've formed healthy attachments, who they truly believe is like their protector, their hero, their guide, and you know, and like the person who basically has raised them and cared for them and kept them alive, like a lifeline, basically, it is now learning all these new horrifying things about their attachment figure. Well, that is, whether they're true or not, that's like a huge, huge betrayal, and it's very traumatic. And so if a child, like, and there are cases where like this can actually turn into like a completely, like, the kids choose to never see that parent again because of all the new things that they believe about their parents. So that these children can grow up actually believing that their attachment figure has turned on them and abandoned them, when in reality, that's not the case. Or that their attachment figure is not who they thought they were, which is also not the case. Just because two parents can't work it out between the two of them doesn't mean that they don't love their children or that they don't want to be there for their children as much as they were before. It just means that they couldn't work it out as a couple. And so for a child to grow up having that belief where like they started out with these two secure attachment figures and then that trust was broken, and now they have to restructure their belief system where it's like, oh, my daddy really isn't my hero. My daddy really isn't that the amazing hero that I thought he was, because mommy's saying he's an evil. That's very traumatic for a child. And then they grow up becoming, you know, adults who believe that they were abandoned or misled by their father, which in reality was not the case. It was just that was the picture that was painted by their mom, or vice versa. That's very damaging. And then that can also affect how they feel about themselves, how they feel about themselves as adults, as potential spouses, as potential parents themselves.
Wow. Wow. And like I said, this is something that is really a whole other podcast episode to be. Yeah. But I do want to say that that is something that, you know, men can be victims of just as easily as women. I think, you know, if you're talking about, you know, situations where, you know, the woman may be physically weaker and more likely to be a victim of, say, physical abuse, and other areas where the woman, you know, may be more statistically more vulnerable. I think that this is something that you definitely see in men. I don't know what the breakdown is, but you can definitely see that in men, and men can be just as vulnerable.
Absolutely. I mean, I like that.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said I have a case right now that I'm representing the man, and his children are being absolutely alienated from him because the mother is the custodial parent, well, has physical custody of the children. And he, when the kids come, it's just a mess because these kids are led to believe things that are not only false, because it could really, truly, they couldn't be further from the truth. But it also has to do, I think, and Anna, you would know better than me, but just from what I've seen, it also goes with the loyalty of the children, meaning they feel like if they're not mean to mommy or daddy, or if they show any love towards mommy or daddy, meaning the parent they're being alienated from, they're betraying the other parent.
Yes.
And that is something I see a lot, where kids have to pick where their loyalties are. And
yes,
it is horrible. And they feel like they have no choice. And what I have seen from that is as the child grows up, they naturally, not only do they feel a lot of guilt, but they become closer with the parent that was alienated because they felt like they were withheld from having a relationship with them.
Yes. Yes. And so completely unfair to do to any child to mess around with their belief system like that, and even not even force, but even just place the suggestion that they might have to take sides.
Yeah,
that should never be on a child's radar.
It's child abuse.
It is. It is. And
right. When you're talking about
completely unfair.
Right. When you're talking about parental alienation, you know, the way I view it, I could be wrong, is that it's an extreme end of what does often happen in divorce cases. So people may say, well, I'm not alienating one, the other, my ex, from my children, but that doesn't mean they're helping them have a healthy relationship. And you can correct me if I'm wrong here.
No, I agree with you. I think a lot of times when a parent will say, you know, and the kids will overhear, oh, we don't have, we can't get we can't get groceries because he decided not to pay for my credit card anymore. And the child overhears that and says, oh man, daddy's not, you know, not paying for our groceries. What a piece of garbage. It could be done subliminally. It could be done on a lower scale, but it still happens. And it does. And when a parent does things like that or says, "Oh, we can't go on vacation because daddy or mommy won't let you out of the state," well, that's going to put a bad taste in the child's mouth, and that is not how you foster a relationship between your child and your ex. And that is a huge, huge problem that I see very, very often. And sometimes it's done maliciously, and sometimes it's just a lot of tone-deaf parents.
Yeah.
Or they just haven't dealt with their own issues, which is what I'm going to throw back at you in a second, Anna, because, you know, I'm a pediatrician, and this is what actually sparked my desire to have this conversation with the two of you, is that Yael had posted some post about a narcissistic parent using their child in a tug of war. I don't remember that exact post, but this is what, unfortunately, I've seen throughout the years as a pediatrician, not necessarily parental alienation. You know, I have not really seen that more extreme end particularly. So many times though, have I seen the situations you're mentioning where one parent is demeaning another parent or undermining them. You know, and one parent will come in and say, well, you've got to tell, you know, my child to do X because the mother said this or something like that. It's just putting all their baggage right in front of the child. So what can we do to not do that, Anna? How can we help families in this process to not get kids caught in the middle?
Listen, I'm not saying it's easy, and I don't envy anyone who's in this situation at all, because many times you are dealing with a really tough situation, and sometimes people are dealing with messy divorces, and there's a lot of really personal hits that you're getting from it, like hits on your self-esteem, on your self-worth, you know, your worthiness of like, I couldn't make it as, you know, as a wife or a husband, I couldn't make this person happy. And you're definitely not feeling, you know, at your best. And whether your soon to be ex or your ex-spouse is on board with what's going on with the kids, or you're not, like, or you're in disagreement over certain things, it's really important to keep all that really separate from the kids, because the kids are going through their own severe adjustments, like very serious, harsh realities of like the fact that mommy and daddy are just not together anymore. This is my new reality of having to bounce back from house to house. And you just want to avoid this, any kind of, thoughts being put into your kids' heads of like that their other parent is something negative. You know, let them figure that out. Let them work out their own feelings about mommy or daddy. You know, let them work that, because they're going to have confusing feelings themselves. And sometimes they've seen how their parents treat each other in the house without you saying anything. Let them draw their own conclusions. Let them work out their own relationships with you guys. And you guys work out your own relationships with your children as individuals. If you need therapy, you can go to therapy. But the relationships with your kids and your ex, that shouldn't be, you shouldn't really be getting too involved in that, unless there is like an abuse issue or like a dangerous issue, an abuse issue, or a legal issue. But in terms of like disagreements that you're having, you know, on like just how many days a week, or should the kids be in karate or should they not be in karate, or when you're going to take vacations or not, like don't bring the kids into that, and really keep those conversations separate. Have those conversations in your car, at the office, after the kids go to bed, but don't start having these conversations and saying like, well, I was going to take you to Miami, but you know, mommy says that you have to be with her and Bobby and Zadie during that week because they planned that, you know, months ago. So next time, you know, whatever, I'll just have to go without you. Like, don't just say, you know what? I know I said Miami, but this time, you know what? Mommy and Bobby made really good plans to spend with you over this winter break. So I promise we're going to go to Miami a different time, but you're still going to have a really good time with mommy. And then deal with your own feelings on your own in therapy. Talk to your friends, talk to your family members, whatever, get your own support. Don't bring the kids into it because they have enough going on for themselves as children going through a divorce. Don't bring your issues into their lives.
Right. And I've seen a lot of families who do get special, you know, therapy for the children. And sometimes they even do family therapy.
Yep.
With everybody all together. That happens sometimes.
Yep. And the other thing that some families do, if they can work it out, I've met several families that do this, is that the parents, you know, have no choice but to get divorced, and that's the best thing for both of them. But for the sake of the children and the family they have now created, they still do things as a family. Mm-hmm. So they'll still have Thanksgiving together sometimes. You know, both parents, you know, divorced parents with the kids. And sometimes they'll bring along other family members or friends, but they'll still get together for Thanksgiving to give the children that experience to be with their parents on Thanksgiving as a family.
We do that.
Like, you know, if you can swing it and everybody's comfortable and okay, and you put your differences aside, I think it's really nice for the children to see that and experience that.
Right. And that's presuming that you have two intact people, which may not be happening.
More or less. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So Yael, I really wanted to hear from your viewpoint. I'm really wondering about how it works in Beis Din versus secular court. I mean, I know secular court is by nature very adversarial. I had a family, and I will never tell stories of my patients with any identifying information. And this was like a kabillion years ago, but I had a father that came in and he was fighting for custody of his child, which, you know, unfortunately I've dealt with a lot of. And he said, I'm taking this all the way to the Supreme Court, the Brooklyn Supreme Court. You know? So, yeah. So that was a very adversarial. I've been in a lot of these situations where it's extremely adversarial in the secular courts. So I'm just wondering how it is in Beis Din.
It's the same.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell me it's less. In this article, it said that many people had good experiences in Beis Din. I don't know.
Oh, the experiences can be great in Beis Din, meaning there is a sense of things being more comfortable because, you know, it's a bunch of Jews. You're not in a scary, sterile courtroom with a judge you don't know versus when you are in a Beis Din. And yes, it's hard to be the only women, but there is still a comfort there because, you know, there's a chance you're going to see the dying at, you know, the neighborhood kiddush. It's a much different kind of scary. I think also in Beis Din, you feel more comfortable to be yourself. So because you're with, you know, the community, I think that, you know, things can become a little bit hysterical sometimes because you do have that comfort level. And I think most people would say that they have a good experience in Beis Din. But that doesn't mean that, you know, it wasn't contentious. there's always fights.
Contentious and adversarial are two different things. I'm not saying it would be easy. You know, the way divorce, you know, can often work is, you know, one person wins and one person loses. Do you know what I mean?
I think in Beis Din, because you're dealing with more or less your community, I think sometimes the emotions are higher as opposed to when you're in court, where it's more like you don't know the judge, you don't know the judge's family, you don't know that the judge's family came to America right after the war, had five kids. You know what I mean? It's totally their grandmother is your grandmother's best friend and you grew up together. And so if you don't get something that is 100% on your side, you get insulted, whereas a judge doesn't know you from a hole in the wall. So if you don't get the ruling that you wanted, it's less personal. And it's much more personal and Dustin.
I see what you're saying.
Right. So it's much more personal and Dustin. But I think overall, in most cases, and I'm not saying every case, and I'm not saying in every situation, but in most cases, I do feel Besden is much better, specifically for the children and custody issues.
I mean, would it be correct to say it is closer to mediation than secular court? Or am I completely wrong?
No, here? No. I mean, it's not closer to mediation because it is, no. At the end of the day, it is a court. And you do have somebody representing you and litigating on your behalf, and there is a process. So it's not really like mediation, but the Beis Din usually, because we're all Jews and because, you know, there's more of a sense of a familial setting, you know, there'll be more emphasis on the children. There'll be more emphasis on the single mother. Again, this is not true for every Beis Din either. That's why I'm very specific and very conscious of which Beis Din I use for which situation. Because not every Beis Din is great for a single mother. Not every Beis Din is great for a single father. So I'll make sure to use which Beis Din I feel is best for that specific situation, for my specific case.
Right. When you say not best, what exactly do you mean?
I mean, so I know this Dayan is very sensitive to single mothers. So I'm going to make sure to go to that Dayan's Beis Din. We'll make sure that, you know, he hears this case because he, you know, he's a big softy. Whereas I know this other Dayan, who, you know, whose wife, he and his own wife got divorced many years ago, and he, whatever, he got very upset and he's going to side more with the husband. And I'll make sure to use that Dayan if my client is, you know, in that position. Because at the end of the day, as much as they're arbitrators, depends on how you say it, tomato, tomato.
They're human, right?
They're human beings. And it would be silly to think that they could be 100% in the middle.
What would you say people should know to do well in the system?
Keep your side of the street clean. And don't fall into the narrative. If the other side, meaning, so your side of the street clean, mean it means that let them mess up all you want. You stick to what the agreement is. You always do what you're supposed to do. Don't do anything that you're not, don't do anything you're not supposed to do. Even if you think it's unfair, you do it anyway, because that's what you're told to do. It's almost like, you know, shut up and sit down kind of thing. Because if you, even if you think it's messed up and you think that it's not fair to you, if you show that you're compliant and you're willing to respect the Dayanim, then you are going to get a lot further than sitting there acting like a meshuggah and saying, no, I'm badafka going to go against what the Dayanim said.
But you're acting in good faith. You're acting in good faith. I mean, correct. As a parent of a child with special needs, it's making me think of going to those committee for special ed meetings and you have to work with the system.
I know those well. I know that my son has autism, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
My daughter too,
And it is quite like that. And also, when I say don't fall into their narrative, every divorce has a narrative. No matter what it is, there's a narrative. It might be that the other side says you're crazy. It might be that the other side says that you're a bad mother or a bad father or you're not good with money. Whatever it is, you do everything possible to make sure you don't fall into the narrative. So let's say they say that you're irresponsible, you're an irresponsible mother because you always miss doctor's appointments and you're always late. That means you're now, for now on, you're 5 minutes, 10 minutes early to every single appointment, including the appointments in Beis Din, to your hearings, to your lawyers, to phone calls, to this, that, and the other thing. You're early and you're going to schedule every single doctor's appointment 6 months in advance. Because if not, you're falling into their narrative.
Right. Put your energy into putting yourself in a good light, as opposed to what I unfortunately see, which is put your energy into making your ex look in a bad light.
Right. So don't, so I always say, don't concentrate on the other person. That's not the point. You concentrate on yourself and on doing the best job that you can.
And that'll make it less adversarial, whether you're in base dean or whether you're in secular court.
Correct. I mean, it's the same, not that I can give legal advice. I'm not an attorney and, you know, right. I'll never pretend to be, but I do work with a lot of attorneys. And it's something that, you know, I always give this speech in the beginning to my clients. And a lot of the attorneys that I work with on many, you know, on different cases, they would say, you know, I started giving that speech because of you, because you know what? It works. And it's true. And I said, yeah, well, it does work. Because it's important for everyone to know. Sorry. It's
right. And this really is the same for a Jewish divorce as a non-Jewish divorce. It's the same principles. Right. You know, these are all ways to make it less acrimonious, which everyone will win from that. Everyone right. loses. From all the acrimony and all the fighting. I do want to touch upon the halachic prenup. I thought you were going to say get a halachic prenup, but you didn't.
No, I did not.
I know that you work in different types of Beis Dins, right? Like some might be, you know, more in the modern end and some more to the right. Am I correct about that?
Yes. So I deal with all of the above. Although the halachic prenup is something that's more in the modern world.
Right, right. So I wanted to mention it, but then I wanted to say that we, you know, from JOMA are here just for, you know, medical or mental health, that kind of information, and we don't discuss halacha. So I wanted to mention it only because in circles that use it, you should use it. I don't know if you want to make a comment on that or not.
I will make a comment. My comment is you should use it if it's something that is realistic in your community and right. that is something that will be recognized. However, be very careful with where you sign up for it.
Meaning what?
Meaning that I've seen the biggest issue I've seen with halachic prenups right now is that, you know, they sign a halachic prenup and nobody was enforcing it, not the Bezin that they signed up with, not the Dayanim, not the rabbi. It's a big problem. And that is the biggest problem that I have seen, and that has been the biggest issue right now.
Is that because people sign halachic prenups, but their circle doesn't use them?
No, that's more... yeah, I think so, and also because it's such a fresh and new thing, that I don't even know if rabbis noted how to enforce it properly.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Also, not like here, it's in Toronto, we don't, like, they don't recognize it here yet.
Really?
Yeah, they don't do it here. Like, we know what it is, we can sign it, but it doesn't really have a lot of, no, exactly, it's not enforceable here.
Right.
And I'm sure other places as well.
You're very right. Yeah. I have to be careful with what I say because I don't want to get into too much hot water.
Yeah. Right, and again, like I said, we're not. None of us are here to be pushing a certain agenda here. We're not pushing a feminist agenda. We're not pushing a hashkafic agenda. We're just putting information out there.
I thought that's it was just, important it's just to new.
It. I mean, yeah, it's new.
Yeah. And it's new.
It's new. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and not that it's not going to get out there, but like hopefully word will spread. It will become a regular practice. Just at this time. It's just not out there yet. It's not all the way out there yet. It needs to be out there. It does. Okay. It's just not.
I mean, my understanding, it was on the front cover of Mishpacha magazine, which is a more, you know, Haredi paper that they were looking to. I mean, we're not going to get into the halachic issues of why it would not be accepted, you know, in more right-wing circles, but they were putting out information about a more acceptable version of this. So we'll see. I mean, we mentioned it. I felt that it was important to mention it and speak to your Rav about that piece.
If it works in your circles and if you have an attorney look over the prenup prior to signing it, then please go for it. If not for you, but for generations to come, so it becomes the norm.
I do want to mention that Ricky Feldman, I keep talking about her podcast. She did a podcast with you as well, Yael.
Yes.
And there's much more. I purposely did not go into, you know, more of an interview about you and how you got into this. And it's very interesting what you do. But I really wanted to focus on the mental health aspect so people can listen to Ricky Feldman's podcast. And she also did one with Keshet Star of Ora, which is that organization to work with Agunas. So if people want to listen to that one, they also can. So I think that's really helpful. We didn't really talk so much about divorce in the setting of abuse. And I think we need to mention that. And I told you, Anna, that I would give you an opportunity to discuss what we did not discuss in our other talk. These talks are meant to be listened to as a trio. They each have a piece of the puzzle. So we did talk about intimate partner violence, which is a newer term for domestic violence or spouse abuse. So cycle of abuse.
Yes. So I think what's really important to keep in mind, and this is what a lot of people will express when they're contemplating divorce from an abusive spouse, is they, you'll almost always hear them say when they're still in the contemplation stage, and Yael, maybe you can relate to this, but, well, I just don't know if I should leave because we do have some good times together. And sometimes we've had some good times, and, you know, he usually does say sorry, right?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, right. Because are you relating to this?
Yeah, I'm saying, oh, my God, because I dealt with that today. You know, I had I had a meeting today where the woman called me to ask me what divorce would look like for her. And the reason why she is not pulling the plug, although she is being 100, I mean, obviously I'm not a therapist, but it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see that she is being gaslighted. She is, I mean, it's really an emotional abusive situation, emotionally abusive situation.
Right.
But she lives for the high. Like,
Right
now it's worth it because when things are good, it's so good that it's worth to take the bad. And that it's almost like she's addicted to it. And I said, listen, you know, I think you need to speak to a therapist. I don't think I'm the person, you know, I'll never tell somebody to get divorced. So I'm not the person to speak to.
Right. And so what a lot of people don't realize is that abuse actually goes in four stages, and part of the abuse cycle is the reconciliation and calm stage, which to them feels amazing because it comes after the violence stage, whether it's emotional violence or physical violence. So the way the cycle starts is stage one is that the abuser is, it's called tensions building. So the abuser is thinking up the next way that they're going to abuse their spouse. So like, how can I, what's a good way? What's a good way to make her feel that it would break her down, take away her self-esteem, make her doubt herself, all the gaslighting stuff, make her think this is all her fault.
What's crazy to me is that it's a conscious thing.
Yes and no. It comes very natural. Abusers, like, this comes very naturally to them. If you would call them on it and say, you were planning this, they would say, no, I wasn't. But to them, to abusers, unless they're thinking up a way to break down their partner, then something feels wrong. Just being okay in a relationship feels wrong to an abuser. They always have to be thinking up a way to break down their partner because it's about them, right? And how they're lacking in something. And so the way that they get their satisfaction or security is by breaking down the other person. So conscious, subconscious, whatever it is, the tensions are building. So that's when they're like in the planning stage. How am I going to break her? Then it's the actual incident where it's either a big blow up fight, gaslighting, questioning the person, you know, the partner's sanity. It could be a physical fight. It could be some sort of abusive act. That's like the really, really, really hard part when divorce is thought about, brought up, talked about, when, you know, the victim is sometimes running from the home, crying, screaming, calling out for help, or just suffering in silence, whatever it may be. Then after that, there's the cool down, right? So then the abuser sees, okay, I got her. I broke her down. She's questioning her sanity. She's all confused. And she's talking about, you know, all these destructive ideas. So now I'm going to come and I'm going to make it up to her, bringing flowers, chocolates, apologizing. I'm so sorry. You know that I still love you. You know that, you know, I only do this for your own good. And I only do this because you needed it. And a lot of, you know, just like calming down, making them feel like, you know, oh, well, you can't live without me. you can't live without me and it's going to be okay because I'm going to protect you and I just do this for your own good. And it makes the victim kind of like question their own sanity, but also really feel like, okay, really he does love me. This is my fault and things are calming down. And then there's the calm part where not a whole lot's happening in this period of time. Things are actually going okay. And that's when, you know, as a therapist, I'll see clients come mamash in the height of crisis when things are just going like horribly. And I'll be talking to them about like, you know, maybe you want to try a trial separation. This is really not a healthy pattern. And they'll come to me 2 weeks later and be like, no, things are pretty good right now. Like, you know, thanks for your help, but I think we're good. We're good now. You know, or they'll cancel the appointment and email me and be like, we're doing much better. You know, sorry for bothering you. And then like 2 weeks later, cycles, or 3-4 weeks later, the cycle's going around again. And it's a 4-stage cycle. And it just keeps going and going and going and going and going. Yeah, that's how it works. And that's basically how you recognize abuse. So when somebody comes to you and is saying that they're contemplating divorce, but they don't know what to do because there are really good times. And my question is, yeah, but then what happens to those good times? Why don't they last? Why do they always end up repeating the cycle again? What does that say to you? What does that mean to you? How can you explain that to me?
Right. And also love shouldn't hurt, like the title of that talk we did.
Love should not hurt. No.
I love that, by the way. Love should not hurt.
So right, and that's the answer to that, right? That mm-hmm. the good times do not outweigh being abused. You should not be abused.
Right.
So for someone who's really in danger, right, they may struggle to get out of it just because they can't figure out how to do it safely.
Right.
I don't know if we talked about that in our other talk about having an escape plan. I think it should at the very least be mentioned here too.
100%.
Yes.
It's very important.
Yes. Yes. So do you want to?
No, go in.
Okay. So I would say like, if the victim is aware that this needs to be, you know, happening in the near future, then he or she, usually it's the wife, needs to work with a therapist or a caseworker, or even maybe Elle can help them with it in her position, creating a plan on how they're going to exit with their children in a safe way that's not going to create any kind of harm or legal issue or any kind of violent situation. And sometimes it can be extreme and sometimes it can be more simple, but usually if it's gotten to this point, it's because there's a lot of fear of what might happen if they leave the abusive partner or spouse. So it's about finding a safe place for them to live, how they're going to be financially supported, how the children are going to be safe, how the children are going to understand, you know, what's safe, what's not safe. What kind of safety plans, like how do you go about it with your clients?
So it's actually really interesting that this came up. I actually just started a non-for-profit along with my father.
Nice.
Wow. Yeah, for women who, not just Agunos, because that is a big part of it, but women who are getting divorced, don't have the funding to, don't have the money to hire an attorney or towin/towinus, housing, therapy, all of the above, which is so important for women who are trying to get out. And it's something that I do very often in my practice where I'll have a family member call me of the person who is, you know, being abused and say, listen, we're ready. She's ready. I'm bringing her to you tomorrow. We need to make a plan. What can we do? And usually, you know, we'll have a meeting. We'll assess the situation, the danger level, get the necessary restraining orders if necessary, have the family member go to the house, make copies of important documents, passports, financial records, make sure that everything is in compliance with the law. So God forbid, there are no issues with kidnapping and all that fun stuff. And make sure things are done in a legally sound and safe way for both the mother or father and the baby. Because I have seen this with, and the children, I've seen this with fathers, unfortunately, as well. And I think mm-hmm. it's important to note that, no, women aren't the only people who get abused in marriages, even physically. And it's something that, you know, is a large part of my practice is just strategizing how to help someone leave an abusive marriage and how to do it safely and discreetly.
Hmm.
Wow. So, you know what, guys, it's really late. We have so much more that we could be talking about. And I really give you guys so much credit for doing this so late at night. I hope people understand what you do. And yeah, Elle, because it is really, really unbelievable. The advocacy that you're doing for people who need it so desperately. And again, I'm going to mention to hear more about what you do, to listen to Ricky Feldman's podcast, Call Isha's episode with you. And also to thank both of you and to thank you, Anna, for everything that you do. And for doing this with me, not once, not twice, but three times.
Yeah, no, it's really been such a pleasure.
So thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us. And I can't
wait for having us.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org. That's JOMA.org. Or email us at health@joma.org.